Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Niall Ferguson talk with Susan Jacoby.
Well, you just casually mentioned that all of this, you know, from Luther, who wasn't exactly the most enlightened fellow in the world or the most open to evidence, to Hooke, who's saying this astonishing thing, which is the only way we can expiate original sin is by tasting more of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. But to return to the subject of ignorance, you said 150 years. Don't you think one of the big players in ignorance in Western Europe, at least England and the United States, is the abandonment of history as chronology? You know it took 150 years. You have to know it took place in 150 years to know how amazing it was. As you yourself have pointed out in your little factoids, that something like only a third of graduates of a leading British university know who was the monarch at the time of the Spanish Armada. If you don't have any timeline in your head, how can you think about anything properly?
I think this book is part of an attempt to challenge the ways in which history is taught on both sides of the Atlantic and to make a plea to restore chronological frameworks to the way that we teach. Now, I think this is a bigger problem in the UK than in the US, because in the UK there's been an almost total break with the Great Sweep, whereas most American kids are still given a sweep of American history and a sweep of Western or world history. And I'm not sure how far they really absorb this, but they do go through it in roughly chronological order. Whereas you can study history at a British school and you leap from Hitler to Henry VIII and Martin Luther King Jr., and that's it, you're done. And so you have absolutely no sense of the order in which things happened, and there are whole centuries about which you know literally zero. That's something that scares me, because it does seem to me that having a sense of time, knowing where we are located in the continuum of 4,000 years of the history of civilization, is important. And that most historical phenomena are unintelligible if they are studied and remembered in the wrong order. I mean, you have to know which order these things happened in. And I frequently say, if I'm talking to a relatively young audience, you know, just tell me which order these things happened in. The Renaissance, the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, the First World War. Now, if I've just done them in the right order, but if you jumbled them up and presented the average Western teenager with those things, a tiny percentage would be able to put them in the right order. Tiny percentage. Because that is not the way we teach history. And, of course, if you don't know the order that these things happened in, you don't see the causal connections between them. And that's really a big part of what this book is about. It's about exploring causation. It's a narrative in the sense that I do tell the story pretty much starting in 1411, 600 years ago, coming down to yesterday, or as near as yesterday as I could get. And it's arranged in a chronological order, but it is analytically trying to make some statements about causation, about the order in which things happen, because I think we need to know that.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, by the way, about UK being worse than the United States. You know, a third of our high school graduates placed the Civil War in the 20th century. Now, how can you know anything, for instance, about race if you think that the Civil War took place in the 20th century?
I think the survey data do show that there's almost as big a problem, if not as big a problem as in the UK. So it's something that we should all be concerned about in the English speaking world. But the other problem is that I think there's been a kind of a narrative imposed in some classrooms, in some texts, and by some teachers, which isn't especially helpful. And that narrative essentially says the West grew to be dominant because it was entirely wicked, and that we should study the story of its wickedness from, as it were, slavery on, if not from earlier acts of wickedness. And the notion that the explanation for the Great Divergence is imperialism, is empire and its exploitative character, which is actually very attractive still to some people on the left, is, I think, a very distorted reading of history. So when I talk about the shadow side, that only makes sense because I'm also talking about the light side. And history has to have both in there. And I do worry about accounts of the past which are almost exclusively concerned with the misdeeds of Western empires. After all, the least original thing that Europeans did after 1500 was empire. Everybody did empire. That wasn't novel. So one can't really attribute too much, it seems to me, to imperialism, since it was essentially continuing what all non-Western civilizations had done for centuries.
Well, anyway, as it seems to me, it can reasonably be inferred from your book, wickedness too can only be understood chronologically.
Right, and it certainly can't be seen as a monopoly of Western empires. Heaven knows, there were all kinds of dreadful things being done by non-Western empires at the time that the Europeans showed up. I don't think I would have enjoyed living really under Aztec rule if I had that option open to me.
Not at all. Your head might have been the cornerstone of a temple.
Yeah,
with my luck.
This is an extremely important point. There are some. We all need a narrative. We all need a storyline. I think there's an agreement on that, particularly when we're learning history for the first time. But part of what I'm trying to do in civilization is to give a properly balanced narrative in which we understand that the ascent of the West is probably the biggest story in history after 1500. It's something that needs explaining, but it can't be explained exclusively in terms of slavery and exploitation. Those things are part of the story, but they're probably not the best explanation for it. I mean, I don't actually think one can explain terribly much in terms of Western ascent, in terms of the enslavement of Africans. A terrible phenomenon though that was, it is unlikely that it had as big an impact on Western ascendancy as the Industrial Revolution, or for that matter, the Scientific Revolution.
One reviewer made the point that in your book you almost completely ignore the rise of the common market in the European Union in 20th century European post-war history. Why did you do that, or do you simply consider it irrelevant to the larger issue of where our civilization is headed now?
Well, it's something I've written about in the past. In fact, if you go back to 2001, I published a book called The Cash Nexus, which has an entire chapter on European integration and particularly on monetary union, in which I wrote...
I thought that happened in 1901.
Well, the process of European integration did not really begin until the 1950s. And its culmination with a monetary union, which was devised in the late 1990s, and I use the word culmination deliberately, is one of the most interesting phenomena of modern times. But when I wrote about it in The Cash Nexus, my point was this. The monetary union is a step too far, and the system as they've designed it, monetary union without any fiscal federalism, will break down after about 10 years. And indeed it has. And we are witnessing now a process of European disintegration, which I think has been going on practically since the creation of the euro. The euro is a terrible mistake. It is extremely difficult to unmake that mistake. But people who are interested in my thoughts on that subject need to go back to the Cash Nexus. In the great scheme of Western ascendancy, I think the story of European integration rates at most a footnote, because it's not the big story of post-45. The big story of post-45 is the polarization of the world into two alternate models of Western civilization. The one that we think of as capitalist, and the alternate one that had been devised by Karl Marx, Engels, and their successors and imitators, which had established itself in Moscow. That's the big story of Europe post-1945. And I tell that story using a rather nice image, and that's the image of blue jeans. And I ask a question, which I think is a good question. Why was it that the Soviet system couldn't make blue jeans, workers' overalls, admittedly developed in the United States, but incredibly simple to make. And it was a sign of the utter failure of that system to be able to manage a consumer society or even produce a consumer society that it couldn't even make jeans.
It couldn't, and it couldn't repair apartment buildings. I guess one of the things that makes one feel, you know, we're entering an end time scenario, as you put it, is the breakdown of a lot of the kinds of services which have always been taken for granted in Western countries. And this is something one can see even in one's own lifetime, that the level of service, and by service I mean the repair and upkeep of everything that makes the Western standard of living good, has degenerated enormously in the last 40 years.
But at the same time, an incredible technological revolution has been unleashed.
That's the paradox.
That is, in a sense, leaving much of that traditional infrastructure by the wayside. I think it's important to recognize, before one gets carried away with millenarian visions of the collapse of the West, that there are certain things that still are being done uniquely well in the West. And I mean here, the very West, as in Silicon Valley. If there's one thing that seems to illustrate the power of the killer apps today, it's the extraordinary way in which that part of the West, the westernmost part, remains the cutting edge of innovation. And it's a combination of competition and science and actually a system that protects intellectual property rights pretty well. And all of those things combined that produces the extraordinary transformation of communication that is perhaps the biggest story of the last 20 years.
Yes, but don't you think that there is another side to that too? One being that, I mean, it's a wonderful thing, but the idea that you can just go and pluck out a factoid, which you can very easily now with all of the digital tools we have, but not really know anything about what lies behind it.
Well, the problem we have is that we can now generate as much information in the space of 2 years as had previously been generated in the entire history of mankind. I mean, this vast data dump that happens every single day is at once an enormous opportunity, but it is also a massive challenge to our cognitive powers, because our brains are not really that different. Evolution hasn't moved that fast in the space of 4,000 years of civilization. My worry is that particularly the younger generation who are growing up in this environment of mass distraction with constant bombardment and a constant communication, cannot read War and Peace. Reading War and Peace, which I did twice as a teenager, changed my life. And I keep asking my kids and my students, do you have the concentration power to read War and Peace? Or will you just not be able to because of the SMS messages, the emails, and the Facebook page, and the tweets and the alerts that are constantly bombarding you? Now, since civilization is transmitted by book more than by any other mechanism, since it's that which transmits the learned accumulated wisdom of one generation to the next, maybe the big danger here is that our communications revolution, our ability to communicate as never before, has somehow damaged our capacity to absorb long sustained works of literary achievement, like Tolstoy's magnum opus. That's a great concern of mine. And towards the end of the book, I say, well, what should our Quran be? If we're going to take at least a few texts and privilege them, what should they be? What are the essential books we want everybody to have read? And I find myself rather despairing that this project will ever be fulfilled, that we'll ever really get to the point when we regard somebody who hasn't read War and Peace as just incompetent to hold high office, or somebody who doesn't know the works of Shakespeare is disqualified from presidential elections. I mean, we obviously won't get to that point. But the decline of our ability to engage in long reads of big books, does worry me.
And also the general fact that there is all this information, but information and knowledge are two different things, and not all of the unfiltered information in the world enables people to think about, well, what's important and what isn't.
An interpretation and understanding require things to be left out. I quote Thelonious Monk early on in the book, who said that in jazz it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play. And I hope readers of Civilization, which is an admirably short book, I think, considering that it covers 600 years, I mean, readers will enjoy the things the notes I don't play, the things that aren't there.
Well, you conclude with a statement that we're our own worst enemy, that if we do go the way of Rome, it will be because of our own fecklessness and ignorance of our own institutions and history. This is kind of a reverse twist on the old 1960s statement, we are the people our parents warned us against. If that's true, and one looks at the 2012 presidential campaign so far in the United States, and who could deny it, in which ignorance has so far been paraded as a great virtue, what would have to happen to make us address our own deficiencies instead of seeing either immigration or a class of civilizations as the main problem and our wonderful selves as bearing no responsibility at all?
I think this requires a special kind of leadership, leadership which is a very rare thing, the kind that Churchill himself personified. Churchill's an interesting figure for a variety of reasons, but the most important things are, one, historical knowledge. This is a man steeped in the study of history, and two, a readiness to tell his people unpopular things that they did not want to hear and pay the political price for that, as he did in the 1930s in his wilderness years. That kind of leadership is in pretty short supply on both sides of the Atlantic right now, and we have to find that kind of leadership. Because what we're going to have to do in the next, not 100 years, but the next 10 years, is engage in some pretty thorough institutional reform of the way Western civilization works, right across the board. You mentioned education. We have a massive problem in our system of public education in the United States. It is not delivering, particularly for people in poorer neighborhoods. That has got to be addressed. And I think the only way to bring that leadership to the fore is to make people more aware of where we're falling behind, to shatter the complacency that says, oh, Neil, relax. In the future, everything will be designed in California but assembled in China. My book is saying, no, that is not the future that you're going to get. The transition from the West to the rest is happening very fast, in real time, and it represents a challenge not to your grandchildren, but to you today. And if we don't act, if we are complacent, we are going to pay a much heavier price than traditional theories of gradual decline would lead you to expect.
If you were a betting man, I recognize in the last chapter of your book, something editors have said to me is, can't you put something optimistic in there for people to take away? But if you were a betting man, how are things going to go? Are we going to continue this decline you've chronicled, or are we going to wake up? And is it not perhaps a little too late already, especially in educational terms?
Well, I like that Churchill line, that the United States always does the right thing when all the alternatives have been exhausted. And that's my optimistic note, that this is a country which likes a crisis, likes to bring things to a really serious pass, and then gets it right. I fear we're still somewhere through that process, not quite at the end of it. But I think at the end of it, we will get it right. I can't say the same for Europe, which is one reason I'm here.
But as you yourself note in your book, if the barbarians are at the gates, it's already too late. One thing, you don't mention this, obviously you finished this book long before the political silly season started, but the focus of trying to make people think that the problem is without, whether without in terms of immigrants are overrunning our borders or without in terms of alien influences like radical Islam, isn't simply saying the problem is us an act of political leadership which hasn't occurred?
Yeah, I think that's what's needed. The barbarians are us. It's our own uneducated. It's our own dysfunctional families. It's our own deprived underclass that we need to worry about. We can't blame the rest for catching up. Good luck to them. And we can't blame immigrants who want to come here and get away from the failed institutions in their own countries. But what we can do is blame ourselves for failing a generation. And I do think generational politics will matter more in the years to come. At the moment, the young generation doesn't quite know what's going to hit it, as it ends up having to pay for the indulgences of the baby boomers with much higher lifetime taxation rates than the baby boomers had to pay. And, right. And I think the younger generation has been failed not only in terms of these unfunded liabilities that are going to be like a mountain on top of them, but failed also in terms of the the pretty poor education that most of them have been given. An elite has prospered under our institutions, but this cannot be said of the mass.
Thank you very much. And I think anyone who reads this book will realize it also has, in addition to having a chronological argument, it has a discursive quality. And I now know what Rinderpest is, and I'm not going to tell. Thank you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, Scott Horton interviews Stephen Zunes. Dr. Zunes discusses the Arab Spring as the culmination of a decade of peaceful rebellion against tyrannical governments. And he explains how violent revolutions tend to breed more violence and result in authoritarian governments.
Tonight's guest is Dr. Stephen Zunes. He is professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies and is Middle East director for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies, that's FPIF.org, and his own personal website is StephenZunes.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good, thank you. Good to be on again.
All right. Well, it's great to have you here. And I was hoping that we could sort of get, you know, best we can do in half an hour, kind of a tour around the Middle East and a review of the Arab Spring now into the winter of 2011 and try to get an assessment of where the various states of revolt are and, of course, the various positions the United States is taking and intervening.
Be happy to. I guess I could just start off by saying that what we're seeing in the Middle East and North Africa, in many ways, is a continuation of a global trend of popular civil insurrections for greater democracy and freedom. And we've seen them from, you know, Philippines to Poland, from Chile to Serbia. We've it's a phenomenon that's been going on for you know, good 30 years now or more. But it's really, and it's not really the first in the Middle East either. There have been some similar uprisings, but not to the extent that we have seen more recently. And like these other uprisings, they've been overwhelmingly nonviolent. You know, people finding that they actually have more power by coming out in mass, popular contestation, the public space, strikes, boycotts, alternative institutions, that that is an easier way in many ways of tripping up the regime than taking up arms. That is, soldiers are much less likely to fire into crowds of unarmed demonstrators than people who are shooting at them. The regime is less likely to know how to respond to the situation. You can find a lot more people become involved, a higher percentage of the population, not just able-bodied young men, as you often see in armed struggles, but young and old, male and female, Christian, Muslim, secular. I mean, it's been an amazing turnout in terms of the sheer numbers, the millions of people we saw in Egypt, for example. Mm-hmm. And
well, it seemed like when Ben Ali fled Tunisia, like on every channel and every paper, you could just see this giant light bulb went off over Egypt, where they all said, "You can do that? Really? You can just go outside and get rid of them? Let's do it!" Boom, and there they went.
Yeah, well, actually, interestingly, in Egypt, they had been planning just this kind of thing for years. The groups like the Kafaya April 6th movement and others had been, talking quite openly about this kind of popular mobilization. Most people, including myself, in fact, who had been examining it, did think it would more likely happen later, maybe when Mubarak tried to pass the mantle to his ne'er-do-well son Gamal. But so it happened a lot earlier than many people expected. But in fact, there are a number of people, myself included, who actually predicted the Egyptian revolution even before Tunisia happened, because their civil society had been growing there quite a bit. There had been a dramatic escalation of strikes by trade unions. There was there had been a lot of smaller protests, which had been usually broken up pretty brutally, but things, there were stirrings. I mean, often we don't see these things until, you have hundreds of thousands of people in the street and all the media is there and that kind of thing. But as in any kind of popular struggle, it's often the culmination of years of mobilization.
And now for something completely different.